and or suggestions for municipalities. And today we have our last speaker that we're honored to have, who's also a member of our committee, Attorney Judith Dessine, who's an attorney with the Chief State's Attorney's Office here in Connecticut, and she also specializes in her area is in blight as one of the aspects of her duties at the Chief State's Attorney's Office. So she's certainly an expert in this field, and we look forward to having her speak to us. So with that, I would like to introduce Attorney Judith Dessine.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative Grogans, and also the members of the task force to examine procedural problems with addressing blight at the municipal level. And I appreciate this invitation to present testimony, particularly as a member of the task force, which I understand is not the usual practice, but I was so anxious to offer my comments, and the Chief State's Attorney was kind enough to grant me this opportunity as well. But please accept this as the testimony of the Division of Criminal Justice on this matter. This is a problem that the division is fully cognizant of and continues to see as a problem. The problems of blight and the difficulties it raises are for our state and for all of its people. Particularly in areas where blight is visible to the public eye, we find that crime and blight commonly ally, firmly nestling in neglected, deteriorated structures and consuming previously healthy and productive communities like a growing disease pervasively destructive in nature. Theories such as broken windows by sociologists Wilson and Kelling have long recognized that in such areas, crime fighting by police is most necessary, yet not enough to combat the spread of blight. Each broken window, left uncorrected over time, demonstrates that the community does not mind the broken window, thereby making further broken windows acceptable and even normal. Untended properties become fair game for plunder, leave neighbors in an environment repressed with disorder, marked with criminal behavior and unsafe conditions, and spoiled with financial loss, frustration, and fear. Blight exists in every municipality in our state, although the disadvantaged areas and citizens take the brunt of the problem, as over time, they, in particular, have lost their community's control of these issues and generally lack the resources to fight blight or even influence the neighbors to correct and maintain their premises. In our great state, all persons enjoy a right to an equal opportunity for safe and healthy housing and community and require our help to achieve it. We in the Division of Criminal Justice see the elimination of blight as integral to public safety and community well-being. As such, with the division, there is a specialized unit assigned to the prosecution of housing matters that are criminal statewide. It is the overall policy goal of the Housing Prosecution Unit to promote full and prompt compliance with housing matters, which includes violations of state or local building, fire, health, and housing laws that apply to residential and commercial properties, and to assure that criminal landlord-tenant laws, such as criminal lockout and illegal termination of services, as well as criminal damage to property by a tenant that belongs to a landlord, uniformly, fully, and effectively. The division's housing prosecutors are committed to the maintenance of decent, safe, and sanitary housing, handling cases from the investigation through criminal trial. Housing prosecutors are certified Connecticut police instructors on landlord-tenant criminal disputes. They also provide routine enforcement trainings to fire marshals, building officials, health officials, and other public safety officials. We are pursuant to state statute created 51-286 small b of the general statutes, and that says in particular that a prosecuting attorney assigned to assigned to handle housing matters may initiate prosecutions for violations of any state or municipal housing or health law, code, or ordinance, either upon affidavit or complaint of an individual or a state or municipal agency. The experience of housing prosecution unit is offered in the following division recommendation of a solution to blight in our municipalities as follows. The problem as we see it is municipal blight stemming from lack of maintenance of existing structures and premises. Our recommendation is the adoption of a statewide property maintenance code. The Division of Criminal Justice recommends the adoption of the International Code Council's Property Maintenance Code as a state property maintenance and blight code. The ICCPMC has already been adopted by other states and many municipalities in Connecticut and elsewhere, as you have heard from our previous speaker from the ICC speakers. The code should be the minimum state standard and apply in all municipalities to ensure full, fair, and equal protection, just as the statewide fire, building, and health codes provide. The ICCPMC is the preferred code to adopt as it is from the ICC family of codes, just as our state building code is, and therefore is fully compatible with our state building code. In background, the state of Connecticut lacks a statewide property maintenance code applicable to existing structures and premises, which, if adopted, would uniformly require compliance with what we may determine are our minimal standards for health and safety in our communities. The state of Connecticut has in place three main statewide codes that aim to protect persons and property: the fire, which is the fire safety and prevention codes, the state building code, and the public health code. Although the fire safety code pertains to existing structures, it is only in a specified and limited capacity. The complaint subject matter must constitute a fire violation for it to apply. Although critical to the life safety of building inhabitants and its users, as well as first responders, fire codes are not very useful in the fight against general blight conditions. The state building code has provisions that can apply to existing structures, but only when the building official has deemed the structure or a portion of it as unsafe or in danger of failure or collapse, conditions that are usually a result of long-term neglect, which evolved unchecked into a serious and potentially life-threatening emergency that the municipality is now responsible to respond to for the public safety. Therefore, typical maintenance issues most familiar to blight complaints, such as broken windows, garbage, or deteriorated structures, do not generally get addressed by the building code. The public health code sections can address conditions of nuisance at or about dilapidated, deteriorated structures when they rise to the level of affecting the public health, but still do so in broad provisions which have somewhat insubstantial language that has proved difficult for courts, attorneys, code officials, landlords, and tenants to discern and to apply uniformly and fairly. So besides the three fire, building, and health codes, we do have municipal housing codes, and they are found in a remarkable percentage of our communities and are the main tool where they exist for the enforcement of minimal code standards in existing structures. The prevalence of these housing codes, as well as blight ordinances, as reflected again in today's OLR research report dated November 21, indicates that the municipalities need a legal mechanism to address these heavy concerns. However, in the majority of our municipalities, there is no local housing or blight code, which has led to no help at all. Blight and housing violations are akin to each other and can be addressed within a property maintenance code together. In fact, wisely recognizing the effect of substandard housing and blight on their people's health and safety, our larger municipalities not only enforce a local housing code, but also staff a distinct housing inspection department to ensure compliance. With adequate staffing and support, these programs are highly effective to combat blight and to protect public safety. Indeed, they give people a place to lodge a complaint and receive help on the housing and blight issues that truly affect their day-to-day quality of life. In sum, municipal blight is a real and onerous threat to community health, prosperity, and safety. Currently, the available municipal assistance on these common complaints varies staggeringly by geographical area, which is resulting in the disparate treatment of people with the same kinds of blight and housing safety complaints. Adoption of a statewide property maintenance code will effectively raise the level of well-being in our state for all of its people by requiring a standard not currently at law for a minimum of decent, safe, and sanitary community living. However, effective enforcement will require stepped-up efforts, particularly to adequately staff and train enforcement department officials and strong funding to assist or incentivize property owners with their expected property rehabilitation costs. In conclusion, the Division of Criminal Justice expresses its appreciation for this opportunity to address the task force. We would be happy to provide any additional information you might require or to answer any questions you may have. I thank you. Yes, sir. Thank you. I would like to mention that today happens to be a sorrowful anniversary, which is actually quite relevant to today's discussion, and that is the anniversary of the Worcester Six passing in a terrible fire at a vacant and abandoned building, which I think most everyone knows about. And if not, I'll just mention it was a warehouse fire where six firefighters lost their life in an extremely bad conditioned fire, and it was an avoidable fire. It was avoidable death had the property been properly handled in its prior state. We have facilities around our state that look just like the building in Worcester. We have open mercantiles. We have open residentials. We have firefighters and first responders and citizens who are at risk from these conditions. We have good codes in place that can deal with most of that, but we do still need a housing code regarding maintenance of properties in general that will apply everywhere. I don't believe a separate blight ordinance is necessary from a property maintenance ordinance. I believe that they can be accomplished together, and I believe that the best avenue is a very well-reviewed international code like the international PMC. So we do highly recommend it. I will also let you know, as I've mentioned before, I have provided, per Representative Grogan's request previously, a copy of the state's prospective cost analysis for the creation of the administrating agency that might handle the adopted code should we choose to do that in Connecticut. And I have provided that. That was at the end of a long effort, about a year and a half's worth, of a number of people joining together voluntarily onto a task force that was unofficial, but it represented the interest at the time. And I will just quickly review that the State Departments of Public Health, at the time Environmental Protection, now DEEP, Consumer Protection, State Building Inspector's Office, Fire Marshal's Office, the State's Attorney's Office, the landlord organization, several were present and participatory, including Mr. DeCosmo, as I recall, from our task force. Were you there, Mr. DeCosmo? No, Mr. Podolsky was. The Campbells were, who are in our room, and others. We had other tenant organizations. We had municipalities. We had the code enforcement groups, the Fire Marshals Association, the Building Officials Association, the Directors of Health Association, the Environmental Health Association, and I'm listing them all, sir and ma'am, because I am trying to make it clear that this was really a well-received idea with a lot of people interested in making it work. And at the end of a long effort, we created a model code for Connecticut to consider. We took the 2003 edition, or excuse me, 6 edition of the PMC, and we supplemented it so it fit Connecticut better. We would have to do the same to the 2012, probably, should we adopt this code. But I can suggest that there's a group of people out there that I could easily resummon who are willing to work with this again and want this passed. We don't have the exact numbers of how many in Connecticut have passed this exact code locally, but I think it's probably over 15 by now at least, and I wish we did have the number. But it's also in use, and where it's in use, it's well thought of and well used. So I would like you to know all that, and I would also like to offer my continued help to draft or to be involved with any committee or effort to make this go forward. And in the respect of the Worcester Six, I think we owe it to every first responder out there to make sure that we don't open them up to this kind of tragedy in Connecticut. Thank you. Absolutely. Consistency not only is fairness, it's required at law, and we do see it difficult for people to have that consistency, even within one town, in the enforcement of a matter. But what I also hear to add to that concern and point is that landlords who own over town borders, who own in several property towns, have a bigger problem than most because they have to meet different standards in each town. And it's very difficult for them to plan for those standards and different officials trained in different codes and different ways with different policies. And it makes, if not impedes, their ability to do fair business and own their property in these towns. And it would, I think, simplify things for tenants as well, knowing what standards they can expect no matter where they live in our state. Well, to answer the second question first, if I could, the person who put that together was the former state building inspector, Lisa Humble, who at the time held the position and was speaking with Commissioner Danaher at the time, Commissioner of Public Safety at that time, regarding the plausibility of adopting the code. The commissioner asked her to run the analysis, which she did. So, you know, having no experience in how to do that, I don't know that it's a good or bad analysis. I know that we were surprised that it was that high and didn't necessarily agree that everything she thought would be necessary to administer a new code was necessary, in fact, because our concept was it could probably fold into an existing agency. Hers was it would have to be a new agency, and that's completely undecided. That was all speculation at the time. But her concern was that if you're going to do this, you need to do it right, and I agree with that, and that we need to therefore staff it sufficiently, and I agree with that. I just don't know that we can't use any existing agencies, and at the same time, we don't have one that's agreed or willing to just take this on, and I can't speak for any of them today. This was a 2008 question. At the time, I think I mentioned in a previous meeting, the commissioners involved were Commissioner of Public Health and the Commissioner of Public Safety, because at that time, the Department of the State Building Inspector was within Public Safety still. So the State Building Inspector and the Commissioner of Public Safety were one consideration because the building code's there. And we still think the building code and the PMC being so closely linked, they're coming out of the same family of codes, would make a natural home at the building department for the new code. But the other agency was the Department of Public Health, at the time Commissioner Galvin. And he was very favorable about the idea, the concept, as was Commissioner Danaher, but wasn't certain it belonged with public health. I have no opinion of the current commissioners on these matters. I have asked from people within their departments for those opinions, and I am standing by for feedback from the two new commissioners on this matter. But we're not talking about public safety anymore. We're now talking about DAS, because that's where building is now. State Building Inspector's Office has moved departments, is within DAS. So I have approached the new State Building Inspector, Joseph Cassidy, and asked him, would they support this concept? And he said he would bring it to his commissioner. I'm standing by for their answer. They're in discussion. I have also asked Ellen Plaszynski from the State Department of Public Health to bring this to her commissioner or deputy commissioners. I'm also standing by for their current response. But I'm sure it's a matter of who can afford it. And somehow it's going to require additional staffing to do this correctly. And I think the concept is agreeable, and that's the problem that we have. Right now, code enforcement is done by various inspectors. If housing inspection is done, if blight inspection is done, in any town in Connecticut, it's either done currently by a police department, such as Waterbury, which has a special blight enforcement program, which is actually done by police department officials, officers. It can be done by a housing inspection unit, which, per my testimony, may be separate, or it could be part of a health department job where a sanitarian also does housing inspection, or in a few communities, it's actually the building official. So what we did was we said, well, if you adopt this code, any of you can use it. Your municipality can decide who your official will be that will enforce it, but this will be your code. So if you're comfortable with your health department being your main housing inspection unit, you can keep that. But if you're not and you'd rather have it be a new unit or the building official, that's up to you. This simply is the code that that person will use, whichever department you choose to use as your enforcement official. And we left it like that, and we got stuck, frankly, at the fiscal note. This was 2008. I don't need to remind either of you. We went into a tremendous budget crisis, and everybody said, we don't have the funds for this at this time, so we will have to table the idea, and the table has finally reopened. Potentially. So we are back again with an old and liked concept. And why now, and what's the advantage now? Well, we've improved our code enforcement tremendously. I have, on behalf of the Division of Criminal Justice, trained personally probably thousands of safety officials in this state and continue to do so. They're pretty well equipped at this point in our state's history, I believe, with all due respect to them. They're pretty well equipped to handle many complaints but lack the necessary tool. The necessary tool that they lack is a code which addresses existing housing in a full way so that it applies in any structure, not just rental property, that it applies in conditions that can be well documented, well cited, and well litigated, and fairly cite these things in a manner that is consistent throughout their town and throughout the state. And I believe that this is the code that can do that job better than any other that I've looked at, and I have looked at other models. So I think Connecticut's ready for it. I have a fire training scheduled for fire marshals and inspectors at Central December 17th in 2 weeks. Where I'm told it's sold out, so I think a couple hundred fire marshals I'll be doing a review of enforcement for them. We concentrate on fire violations related to immediate fire safety hazards, but also blight. In December, the building officials get the same thing. They're having a review, again at Central, again a big group reviewing all of their enforcement procedures. And in February, I'm doing the same for the directors of health. So the code officials have been and continue to be trained to do this job. What they need is a better tool and some support on staffing. And what the community needs, because I think they understand, for the most part, the landlords also understand these needs, and have, for the most part, a desire to have their properties well kept and produce a financial result, which is usually why they get in the business. They also understand that when a neighbor is not doing what they're doing with all their hard work, that that can just destroy their entire effort to upkeep their home and keep good tenants. So the good landlords have come to me and said, we need help because the people down the street are destroying our neighborhood, and we are not the fault. We need help with that landlord. So fairness to the good landlords that work hard and those that try their best, we need to do something about the ones that don't and that put our people at risk and that put our neighborhoods into blight.
Thank you, Chairman. And we do, but we have the tools. We have it, and our ordinance clearly defines that we can cite the tenant as well as the landlord. So they got it. They go to court. They go to court. They get a warrant for the arrest. it's where we differ. And we use the criminal aspect of the 7-148 state statute, which allows us to summon you directly to housing court to go before the prosecutor. And if you fail to show up in court, you get a warrant for your arrest or failure to appear. That's the caveat, I guess, in the court. Correct.
The 2008 draft of our code that we did, yeah, I do have a copy of that. I can leave that with the clerk today. I also know that Mr. Ninto, who I mentioned was here two meetings ago from Mansfield Building Department, he was the chair, if you will, of our unofficial writing committee of our draft code, and he has already taken upon himself to proceed with rewriting it to update it. And what I mean is that since 2006, there's been two code revisions naturally done by the international ICC community with peer review and voting and everything that all the other codes go through every 4 years. This code also goes through every 4 years. And what he's doing is he's comparing the 06 to the 12 and seeing what they changed so that we could change our supplement. I could leave you with the 06 version, and then when he's finished, I will also provide you his 2012 updated version. But as far as the criminal provision, if I could just make also a comment on that. I recommend to municipalities that adopt any local ordinances that they have an option of going after an owner or an occupant or both. Depending on the violation, it should be one, the other, or both. And although owners remain responsible for their property generally and at law, the tenant is sometimes absolutely the person responsible for the condition that's blighting the property. And it is available to go after the tenant directly. We do it. We do it currently under the public health code, which says owner or occupant already. The fire code says owner or occupant already. The building code says owner or person doing the work or person responsible. They have that language already. We simply would recommend the same for this code. It is in the national code as well. It was certainly in our supplement, and so was our view that this should apply to structures owned and rented or owner-occupied. The one exception our draft came to, which was by our task force vote, was to exclude only one kind of property, and that was single-family owner-occupied. I would suggest that be considered again. We find that some blight complaints, some of the worst blight complaints, actually come from owner-occupieds. And then again, the type of ones of complaints that come from owner-occupieds can generally be addressed under another code that exists, like fire or health. So we may not have to include that, but everything else was included. Every other person basically was included as actionable if responsible.
Thanks again for your testimony. This is really helpful. In following up on that cost issue, you mentioned there are 15, I think, municipalities that have adopted, roughly. How are they doing that? And they've already adopted it, so presumably somebody there is doing this.
I'm totally guessing on the number. It might be more. I don't think it's less, but I don't know. They are enforcing it under pre-existing housing inspection programs, changing the document they use to enforce. So they already had a health department doing it or a housing division doing it or a building department, and they're just simply changing that local housing code to this local housing code by adopting the PMC as their code.
So from a fiscal perspective, and I'm not even going to pretend to understand how this all works, I'm still learning, but it seems to me you've already got at least some people doing this work at the local level, and so there shouldn't be any increased cost because they're already doing that. And so the question is for everybody else who has a different kind of blight ordinance, if we can substitute this for that blight ordinance and they're already doing something, are we really increasing costs?
Well, the points that were made to us in this larger task force, and this is why it was so helpful to get different views in it, was that there may be different costs because of the need to provide them an opportunity for appeal. We thought that it would be appropriate to provide, as the fire code and building code provides, an opportunity for modification. Modification, you know, when there's hardship and the person can't do it. There needs to be a higher review body, an administrating agency, if you will, that can handle those types of matters, similar to the State Fire Marshal's Office and the State Building Inspector's Office and the State Department of Public Health. So if there were a local order issued by any department at a municipal level under this code, who would they appeal to? Generally, for building code, they first appeal to the municipal board, and then if that's not acceptable to the appellant, then they can appeal up to the Codes and Standards Committee at the Department of Public Safety, now Construction Services. So what we were trying to do is set up a like system because of those same needs with potentially with a property maintenance code. So the expenses locally may not be any different. The expenses for the state was what was conceived as making a difference, and that's where these numbers come from, to create a state agency to run officials to oversee the local officials, similar to the current state building and state fire system. They have assistance available to the locals on call from the state agency officials who oversee the same code, and it's great help because of their expertise in these matters. So, you know, that's where we saw the additional cost. Technically, every town should be doing code enforcement on complaint, but those that don't have a local code have by default very little. They have state statute for landlord-tenant matters under 47A 50 at SEEK, which is health enforcement regulations, but they only apply to rental property, and they're not as fully responsive to complaints as to the issues that covers, as is the PMC. So there should be someone doing it everywhere, but there's not. And as a result, in some communities, there's no code enforcement. Where that might look like an additional cost, it really shouldn't be, because they should be responding with what at least statutory authority they have. And the problem is the locals don't even recognize the statutory authority at times. They say, we don't have a local housing code, we can't help you. And that's the response that citizens tell me they get when they call my office and say, what can I do? My kids have cockroaches crawling on them in their crib. And the local authority says, well, we don't have a housing code. There's nothing we can do. Now, granted, that particular example might be addressed by a health department, but others won't. And it depends on the health department, frankly.
No, I appreciate that. And I think, I guess I raise the question hoping you might have at least some answer, but I think when we look at the fiscal impact of this, that's clearly a piece that has to be taken into account. I don't know if it was for this. And actually, the next question is sort of related, but when this was looked at before, or can you think about how we would do it now, if we adopt the code is really the standards, but you still have to have the statutory authority to have the ability to enforce the standards at the municipal level. So would we be keeping, I guess it's 7148 in place? Is that going to be, I mean, we're really good in Connecticut about adding new stuff and not necessarily going back and looking at what's already on the books and whether it now is still required. Inconsistent, perhaps we should get rid of some things while we're adding new things so that we have one, if the goal is to have one standard, how do we do that? And have you thought about from a statutory perspective?
Yes,
we would go about doing that.
Thank you. Yes, we have. And again, in this task force effort, and I think my brain continued to mull it around the last several years, but what we expect is that there are statutes that would probably be able to come out of the books if we take this in. Potentially, some provisions in 7148. I would suggest, like the fire code, once we choose to have a state code, it preempts local codes on matters covered by it. We could give the municipality authority to go beyond that if they want to be more stringent, but they cannot be less, and that would be my recommendation, and that it would be adopted pursuant to its own state statute. I didn't put this into my testimony, but frankly, the reason why the codes have teeth is because of their penalties. We use them, I would like to say, modestly, in that if people cooperate, even after they come into court with a housing prosecutor such as myself, or I'm happy to notify you that Mr. Lesko is in our room, our new prosecutor for Hartford, New Britain, Middletown. When they come into us, we listen and we try to achieve the code compliance, but we also understand that certain persons end up cited who might need assistance or have difficult circumstances. We do proceed each and every time with an expectation of gaining full compliance to the best of our ability. And some of these codes come in, you know, as they do walk in the door with municipal enactments that go back, I don't know, 80, 90 years. The codes themselves haven't been looked at in maybe 50, 60 years. They don't make much sense to common language today. So, you know, we do need to adopt legally through a statutory enabler. We do need to consider statutory penalties as well. The fire code, the building code, the health code are all misdemeanors. We would recommend this be the same. Now, not to mean we're going to look for people in jail. We look for compliance. But when that one person on the street refuses to cooperate and puts people at risk, the state's happy to take the matter forward.
Do you recall in your prior working group what the differentiators were with the Connecticut version of your maintenance code versus the international code?
Not all the details of it, but I could get you the old one and the new one. Mr. Ninto can be made available for any future meetings. He's willing to come, and he's up to speed on spitting that right back. Respectfully to you, sir, and he could tell you. But I think the major one for us and one of the biggest discussions that we had was the exception of owner-occupies. The national code doesn't accept anybody.
Right, and they should anything. Be, as you mentioned, some of the owner-occupied single families can
single
be some
family
of the most
owners.
Blighted properties in certain neighborhoods. You know, my concern, I've read briefly through the new code, is that we've got an older housing stock, especially in our urban centers, and some of these new standards simply are going to create problems for the existing homeowners. So we're going to need to have a really, and again, bring a group together. For instance, this new code requires 68 degrees. I believe our state code right now is 65. Ceiling height in basements, 6'8". Some of these houses have lower ceiling heights. And there's things in the new code that we're going to have to take a look at. But I just want to ask this question, too. Because we're getting into some specifics, but in the beginning, I think at our first meeting, we addressed or we discussed the fundamental problem, and that's with refusal of certain absentee out-of-state owners to comply with the existing code enforcement. So this is not going to change that fundamental problem with these out-of-state owners, and I think we really need to start to go back to that original first meeting and say, is there a mechanism? Because clearly we see one city in New York where most of these people are residing that just refuse to cooperate with our cities, and they're in most of our urban centers, these investors. And I think that's something that I still want to bring this group back to and look at. Is there a mechanism that we can create to deal with these guys that just simply ignore the fire marshal and the health department, and they're operating freely, but they just never cross our borders come to Connecticut? So that's one of the concerns that I still have, and I'd like to keep the group focused in on these guys that just don't cooperate and we're not able to go after them for some reason, or it's more difficult.
I would agree with you, Bob, that it is more difficult, but we do have a number of out-of-state landlords on the docket every day, every week in the housing cases we bring. Granted, if they don't respond to our service of process voluntarily, because we mail it generally, if they're out of state, then we have to get a warrant, and if they don't walk in, we're unlikely to extradite them over a housing matter, although I did get one done that way over the years, a fire case where it was occupied by a teacher who lived in Chicago and didn't care to come to court, and she was ordered extradited. for the risk she was putting her tenants in. But I would add that with the help of local police, we do a good job at finding people who are responsible, even out of state, and finding an opportunity to serve them or to bring them into the state to talk to them, and then we serve them. So it is a true problem, even after all those good efforts, and I would be very happy to continue to work with you on it. One suggestion I would make is if Connecticut could legally hold an agent responsible under some fashion for the violations. Generally, the codes say owner or occupant, as I said. So if we cite the local real estate agent or manager for the property, that would not be the owner or the occupant, and it's not available as a citation method. So if we were to consider, if you're an out-of-state owner, that you must designate someone in-state to act for you on this property, that might help the situation. That person would have to understand they take on authority of the owner and responsibility at law of the owner. Most of them, when they hear that, say, no thanks, the job's not worth it. But that's an opportunity we could consider. The owners of any property, and this is how I look at it every day, I point, again, to blocks on the wall. If those are all blighted houses on that top row of our beautiful wall in this building, no matter who owns it, they should all be treated the same. So we have to find a method to pursue any owner if they do it that way.
I agree, and I think your comments earlier about having one or two blighted properties on the street really does impact the entire quality and character of a neighborhood, and we're seeing it in our efforts trying to revitalize streets. And it's frustrating when you've got a absentee out-of-state owner that just doesn't care. So again, I'm cognizant of the problem and just trying to figure out what the solutions on that matter.
I think so, sir. I believe that I couldn't name exactly which ones, but from what I understand from discussions with ICC, Dorothy Harris and company, some states adopt it as a mandatory minimum, can't be changed. Some adopt it as a mandatory minimum, could be revised to be more stringent. Others allow certain provisions to be modified locally, certain others not. I think it's totally up to us. The way ICC promotes their codes, as I understand it, and I do fairly well understand this, they say, you know, this is our code, do with it what you please. We would like you to adopt it, and you may modify it as is appropriate for your use. So those choices are totally up to us. But my suggestion is if we allow the municipalities to modify this code, we won't have a uniform code. It needs to be at least the mandatory minimum.
Actually, the definition of owner, I hate to read things, but I'm going to read it because I'm a lawyer and I do that. So right now, the definition in this code is actually really good for what we're talking about. Owner is defined as any person, agent, operator, which itself is defined separately, firm or corporation having a legal, so agent is in there, legal or equitable interest in the property or recorded in the official records of the state, county, municipality, holding title, or otherwise having control of the property, including the guardian of the estate of any such person, executive administrator of the estate of such person, if ordered to take possession. Operator is defined as any person who has charge, care, control of a structure or premises which is let or offered for occupancy. So I think that gets us at least a good chunk of the way there. And so that's the owner by definition. And if the owner can be cited under this code, I think you're getting at least a lot of what we're thinking of under the concept of agent. So the question is, how do we define, maybe we define agent, which is not defined.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. We might have modified that because of this discussion, again, in our unofficial group. But if it is in the definition in the 2012 as including agent, we could cite the agent.
There were a couple questions I wanted to ask, Judy. First of all, just one thing I noted. We were given a chart when this person from ICC spoke, and it indicated, if I counted correctly, that there were six states that had statewide application of the ICC, and there were, out of the total number, which was somewhere in the vicinity of 30 or more states that had some kind of local variations, so that maybe a fifth of the states that seemed to be using the ICC were using it statewide versus by local option to adopt it. People may want to take a look at that chart that was distributed at that meeting. Judy, I had some questions starting with the 2006 working group that you had. You said that that group settled on some changes apart from the owner-occupied change. When you said you would get a copy, does that include something that shows what changes that working group recommended from at least what was then the ICC?
Yes, it does. What it has is all it contains actually are those sections that we changed and the language that we changed it to by section number.
Okay. I would find it helpful if you could explain for us a little more the interrelationship between what the ICC does, the Property Maintenance Code does, as compared with what local Connecticut housing code and anti-blight ordinances do. Because I was trying to figure out by looking at the code to what extent it picked up on and included what towns are apparently commonly writing into an anti-blight ordinance. And, for example, it doesn't even have, at least I couldn't find, a definition of blight. And it didn't look to me as if the regulation of vacant buildings necessarily picked up on all the same things that anti-blight ordinances pick up on. So I'm trying to understand the extent to which this is really a ICC code, is really a housing code, versus to what extent it sort of takes a blight-related approach. And it would help if you could kind of give your explanation of how that plays out.
Certainly, I can try to do that. I believe that the housing codes currently address most of the maintenance issues that, according to the OLR report we received today, are covered in most local blight ordinances today. So when people look at a house and they see broken windows, they see garbage outside, they see deteriorated structure, those are all covered under a lot of these new local blight ordinances. Those are also all covered under the PMC, and they're covered better under the PMC, in that they're explained with a distinct definition. They have interrelating sections which talk about enforcement and definitions in general that can be used. But more particularly, what I find is that each municipality that comes out with a new blight program and a great, great interest in fighting the problems in their community that they're calling blight is actually rewriting or writing a code which is addressing the same issues that some of the other codes on the books already do. And most primarily, those are done through local housing codes. So local housing codes generally address structural problems, garbage, things visual from the street, and functions of equipment and such in the house, conditions of interiors as well. The blight ordinances do the same thing, mostly just from the outside, though. So what the PMC does is it addresses the whole house. The problem is the whole house. If you only look at the outside of the house and you only fix the outside of the house, you will not change the nature of what's going on in that neighborhood. The problems for the people that live in that neighborhood are more than exterior. The outside of the house is a strong indicator of what the inside of the house looks like. And the code enforcement agencies can help people a lot more and help landlords who try their best to keep up their houses a lot more by requiring that it be done in both places. The blight ordinances tend to be duplicative of the efforts of housing codes where they exist. And where they don't, the blight ordinances, you know, usually don't either. So there's nothing there. But there's a lot of similarity as far as what they cover, and most of it's maintenance issues.
So is your conception of the PMC code that it would replace housing codes and would replace anti-blight ordinances?
Or
that
yes.
Would be basically towns could repeal both their housing code and their anti-blight code if they were if the ICC code became statewide?
They could, and it wouldn't be a loss of tools, because what it would do is it would frame those violations within the PMC. And to the extent blight's not used, the word blight's not used in the PMC, it is described in other ways. And the violations that we would call blight in a local code are called something else in the PMC, but they're still addressed in the PMC.
I think it's worth our taking a close look at that, because I'm not 100% sure that plays out in the same way. I mean, historically, my understanding was the housing codes were for occupied housing, and initially the anti-blight codes were for vacant housing, because housing codes typically did not pick up vacant buildings. And then over time, the anti-blight law ordinances seemed to start applying to occupied as well as vacant buildings. And then that, even now, apart from the ICC, raises the question of how do a town that has both an anti-blight ordinance and a housing code, I think it actually is unclear how those interrelate and to what extent something is a violation of either, and the town just can take a choice as to which ordinance it wants to go under. When the representative from the ICC was here, he was asked about which towns in Connecticut have adopted the ICC code, and he said more than one. And then when he was asked to be more specific, he said, well, I think he said West Haven has. And he was asked if he could name a second town, and he essentially said he didn't know, but he knew there were more out there.
Mansfield.
Okay, so my question is, you've said that you think there are at least 15.
Manchester.
I'm not asking you to name
the
15 now. But is there any way that either you or OLR or someone could find out for us? 15 is a lot of towns, especially if they're the bigger towns. And to what extent, I think it would be useful for us to know to what extent towns in Connecticut on their own initiative have essentially sort of preempted their own housing codes by adopting the ICC code on its own. I mean, it makes a difference to me in looking at the situation, whether it's one or two towns or whether it's 15 or 20 towns. And so you said that you didn't know at this point. I don't know if anybody knows. I don't know how easy it is to find out. But I'm wondering if either you could do that or if we could ask OLR to do it instead. Well, it also plays out in sort of the cost impact, maybe for better or for worse. But in the earlier years of the uniform code, kind of what was noted significantly was that those towns that have housing codes are already doing housing code enforcement. Those towns that don't have housing codes and sort of leave it to, I don't know, public health department, the doctor who's in charge of the public health department, they don't do much in the way of code enforcement. When you adopt a statewide minimum code, you essentially have a much bigger impact on the small towns that don't have enforcement capacity than you do on the big towns that already are enforcing housing codes or, since then, anti-blight codes. I believe that the number of towns in Connecticut with housing codes is a minority of all the towns. So that I'm wondering to what extent the fiscal analysis that came back on this was looking at particularly at the smaller towns that don't have an enforced capacity, as distinct from how it plays out with the larger town that already has an anti-blight ordinance, already has a housing code. Maybe there's a little change in what the precise code is they're enforcing, but they already have staff in place versus a town that really has no staff, but now is subject to, is required to do the code. So that may, understanding where those fiscal impacts are may make a difference at the way we look at this. Again, for better or for worse. I'm not sure where it leads us in terms of fiscal impact, but it seems to me it's useful information for us to understand. Unless I'm misunderstanding, and that the assumption was that the state would be doing direct enforcement of a PMC code, but I know that, for example, with the building of the fire code, the state does not do direct enforcement. The towns have to designate a municipal official that does the enforcement. But you have a right of appeal to the state because the state essentially administers the code. And so I'm sort of assuming for property maintenance code that's the structure that would happen. So I'm not even clear whether the cost that's described is an administrative cost of running the state entity, or if it is a recognition that the state would pick up enforcement in those towns the same way police departments say the state police pick up certain kinds of enforcement when towns don't have the capacity. If you want, maybe I've lost the question there.
So I think I've got it.
Started as a question.
I think it came over here.
But I invite you to comment on anything
thank
you.
Thank you. Well, the concept of the fiscal analysis was not for a state agency to do enforcement. It was simply administrating purposes and oversight and modification, appeal, and assisting the locals. Just like the state building inspector's office does, if a local has a problem, they can call up and speak to an official up there and get a review, assistance, a visit, some help, without the state taking over jurisdiction, just simply assisting. Or a legal appeal goes up there, or a modification can only be granted by the state agency, not by the local official of a state code, that is. So that was our concept. We were thinking that the state agency would be the oversight agency and purposes limited to that. They would not be doing direct enforcement. The primary enforcement would be the local authority. And we would recommend it stay that way. Now, as far as costs, technically, each municipality has either a director of health for themselves or they share one with a district of health. And in each district or department where there's rental property, let's say, under 47A, it says in sections 55, 52, 51, and I think 53, if the director of health has a complaint that's verified, I'm rephrasing a little, the word I'm not going to rephrase that's exact is they shall inspect and they shall order. And when you get to the mandatory language in the statutes, I'm sure, Rafi, that you know, and most here know, that's not considered a discretionary provision. They have an obligation. Now, whether they're making that obligation in every small town is another question. But to say that it's a new job for them to enforce is not the case. They already have a obligation to respond to complaints under other provisions. So, again, this would be a replacement of the tool they used to respond to that complaint. They would still have to go, and if they didn't want to do it through health, I think we could leave the municipalities with the choices of which agency they wish to hone this in, just as long as this is the code that's being used by the enforcement agent within their town. And as to how many have adopted, I'd be willing to take that job on, Senator, if you would like. I can contact the code agencies directly and ask them to do a survey for me. I would probably, because it's done in various places, I would probably go through Department of Public Health and State Building to get those numbers, and I'd be happy to do that if you'd like. Sure. Okay.
And one last question. The statute that created the task force basically directs the task force to, it's phrased as, create model blight ordinances for municipalities to use as a guide. I am wondering, since part of what you're involved with is municipal blight ordinances. Do you have any feelings as to whether there's any particular municipality that has an anti-blight ordinance that you think is a particularly good anti-blight ordinance that if we were to be looking towards somebody that has an ordinance that we wanted to offer up as a model, that you would recommend to us be that model?
West Haven, Manchester, and Mansfield.
And you would recommend? But I mean,
I'm joking with you.
No, okay.
The PMC. The blight ordinances that I've seen, and I've reviewed several. I've been asked to review several of during adoption as well. I couldn't really say I could say that one or more is a wonderful example. They all strive to do about the same thing, as this report indicates. I agree it does. And I don't know of one offhand that I would say. I would suggest that there might be some language that municipalities feel very strongly should be included in whatever blight model we come up with. And that's why we expanded our group to almost an open invitation. Give us your input. We want to make sure what we come up with is satisfactory to you, too. And we could do the same and see if we could add some provisions that would be necessary to certain communities. But, you know, I would also mention this. Although the small towns don't do a lot of enforcement, it takes one bad case to cost that municipality an arm and a leg in expenses if the owner won't comply and it gets to the point where the property is in dangerous condition and the town's left with the problem. And that might mean an out-of-state landlord won't cooperate, or it might be an in-state landlord who won't cooperate. And now you've got people who lack minimum safety standards and need to be relocated by the municipality. One property, and I know, Rafi, that you also know this, can cost the town more money than it can handle. And if we address this in a advanced method, if you will, preventative medicine management of code, those costs don't have to hit a municipality that way. We're just looking for minimum standards and a response that's reasonable in every town.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. You know, from our perspective, we have supported from the first meeting some sort of statewide property maintenance code. It's important, I think, to East Hartford and to other communities that at the first level, when whoever is tasked with citing a property, they understand and know what the consistent interpretation is of the provisions of the code that they're enforcing. That is not just, well, a historical reference, or we've always enforced it this way, or we've already always interpreted it this way. It's that consistency that I think is important when the citation goes out, and it's also important the end of the road when there's an appeal, which that's something we're all concerned about, obviously the due process aspects of it. Getting more and more difficult for municipalities, quite honestly, to find people to sit on local boards to be citation hearing officers. And I have some questions and issues with the whole citation hearing process that applies not only just to this, but everything from traffic tickets to everything else. But at the end of the day, I think the citizens deserve to have a consistent interpretation whenever there is a citation. Whenever somebody, whether it be the municipality or otherwise, says there is an issue with your property, regardless of the town, I think that this brings that consistent interpretation at the appeal level, and that's the most important thing. And on some levels, I don't want to overemphasize, it takes a little bit more out of the political world where, like anybody, if my house was cited, the first thing I probably would do would go see the mayor. Then I might talk to my friend on the town council. Then I might talk to this person or that person before you actually get to the actual appeal process. And you're getting a lot of different interpretations, and it really just needs to be consistent. And I think, you know, you probably still would maintain some level of local appeal, but the final decision going to a state board with consistency, I think, benefits everyone, you know, long term. So in addition to just the consistent interpretations and everyone knowing what we're really enforcing, at the end of the road is very, and also, as you alluded to, the ability perhaps to modify, and whether there be a hardship situation or some other circumstances that require a modification, again, take that out of the hands of perhaps a local board or citation hearing officer or even the building department, which is our inspection permits director, is the one really tasked with citing properties in our town, kind of take it out of their hands and put it to, again, the group that understands the code day in and day out and deals with it day in and day out. So,
well, perhaps there could be a review at that new, I'm sorry if I'm saying it wrong, these districts that have been created. Maybe that could be where the reviews are done. Or not, but it's just, you know, I do understand your comments, and I agree with you, Mr. Gentile. I would suggest that the people demand it. The law demands it, that we treat them fairly, openly, equally, and we do try to do that, but politics intervene at times into these matters. One of the groups that tries the hardest to serve its people are the mayors and first select people of our state, and at the same time, they may be a group that we need to also sit down with and work with to help them understand the value of these code provisions for their people in general and to support their code officials in their work, and that is actually serving the community where that code official is just in their administration of their code.
If I could just clarify, I wasn't implying that, in fact, a council member or a mayor of a municipality is getting directly involved. I'm just saying that the natural course of anyone is to go to an elected official where there is an issue, and I think it's helpful to say right from the start, no, listen, I can't deal with that. I don't have jurisdiction over that. That is a state function at this point, and that just helps everyone as we all try to do our jobs day in and day out.
Thank you. And I didn't mean to imply that would happen, but I do know that even if it doesn't, the complaints or the accusations can be made as such, and it would be something we should endeavor to handle correctly, obviously.
Thank you, Chairman. Judy, I agree with you 100% on this. I know we spoke a lot over the years about this, and this is the one thing that intrigues me about the code enforcement with the IPMC is that for everything else, every other law in the state, we have a uniform. Like for a breach of peace, it's the same breach of peace in Waterbury as it is in Mansfield as it is in West Haven. Fire code violation is the same in Danbury as it is in Waterbury. We have these uniform codes that we follow everywhere else. But it's just very peculiar to me that we operate in these silos when it comes to anything blight-related or housing code-related. So I think it's really would be beneficial to, I think, all municipalities to have this code in place. And I really don't see, I know we talked before about an unfunded mandate, but most large municipalities, even larger towns, have some kind of code enforcement in place already. But it varies from town to town. What is a blight, what we do in terms of blight in Waterbury differs what they do with blight in Bridgeport. This will give everybody that guide, that one, Bible basically to turn to and say, hey, listen, this is what we need. This is what we need to follow. So I think it's a great proposal, and hopefully we can look at doing something to get it passed.
If we're going to go down this path, I think it's extremely important that if we're going to create a uniform code, it's uniform, and not to allow the cities to add their own little twists and wrinkles to this. Because, again, consistency, just what Dan said. I mean, if I'm going to invest in Meriden properties, I want to know what I have to do in Meriden, and the same in Waterbury. So we really have to be careful how we're going to go forward, because I don't think you really want other cities or individual cities twisting and turning their little nuances into this code. Because I think it's really essential to create a uniform playing field. thinking we should come back through this body and adopt the policies from the state level. I think, I mean, if we're going to make addendums, I think the addendum should flow through this body. It's having the state create the addendum. So, again, it's a level playing field.
If I could add, please, obviously, under the law, we have to watch out for equal protection and fairness, and it would be important not to treat a landlord differently simply because they reside out of state. There has to be objective other concerns, and there's my best advice is that, you know, as a prosecutor and a part-time professor of constitutional law, we'd be very careful how we draft this. And at the same time, if a property is in violation, whoever the owner, we could make stricter and stronger provisions of enforcement, whoever it is, wherever they live.
I am not suggesting a separate policy for out-of-state landlords, but I'm frustrated by their just, you know, brazen lack of cooperation in certain cases.
I got one good story. Recently, we had a woman in court for she lived in New York, and the property had burned about 18 months earlier. She came to court. She goes, "Oh, when was the fire?" She didn't even know the property had burned. That's just one extreme case, but this is an example of what we deal with some of these out of state landlords.
I call it fire enforcement annual review, and it's all day. It's from 9 to 4. I'm sorry. I could move 200 people if you tell me. It would be tough, though. May I go to my calendar? Thank you. I'm sure I could produce as many code officials as could fill this room 10 times over, and I can boil that down to I can request letters from some of those towns that feel strongly about the quality of this code and present them to the chairs for it, their further use. And I can also recommend to you that each of them, as well as the code enforcement agency groups like Fire Marshals Association and Health Association, they have offered, and they've already been here, to offer their support, and will speak accordingly.
Well, the immediate downside is this going to actually raise the cost of providing housing. And that's a concern, because I think one thing we haven't mentioned up to this point is, looking back, and I've done some research, I asked Peter to get some research to the committee, but I used 2000 to 2014 as a baseline for some comparisons. And I compared the fair market rents, and I used the City of Waterbury two-bedroom, okay, and from 2000 to 2014, fair market rents increased 27%. Inflation over that time period increased by 35%, and property taxes increased 450%. So clearly, you're starting to see there's an economic issue involved here with blight. And if we're adding to the cost of providing housing, we may actually have an unintended consequence and create more blight, because if we're raising the cost of operations or raising the cost of rents, we're having a tremendous numbers crunch. And I'd like the committee to look at the actual operating costs and see where we're going with this, because also insurance costs have increased about 300%, utility costs, water, sewer. So we've got some real structural problems out here at the street level, and I think it's important to take a look at the numbers involved in providing affordable housing, and also, you know, bring that into the consideration of the committee.
If I may, if broken windows works, and that means if we enforce generally and well, then the values in your City of Waterbury that have been keeping your rent values down over time should raise. The whole point is to elevate the entire value to the people and to the properties in these areas. And it may be difficult to turn around an area that's already very, very crime-ridden and downtrodden, but the ones that are on the brink of becoming that way, that are not yet all that bad, are the ones where these programs can work. They can pull it back. And I know cities around our state and towns around our state that are tipping down right now are desperately trying to find those ways.
Judy, I agree. I think we're actually on a downward trend, and I'm very concerned about it. So, again, looking for incentives. I know you picked up incentives in your presentation today. It's extremely important, because I think the first day Ken Murray from New York said it best. He says, until we can take a dollar and invest that dollar and get back $1.10, no one's going to want to come forward and take on this problem. And I'm afraid we're getting back 90 cents right now. So we've got some, again, structural issues I'd like to explore as well.
If I may, as to that point, we were very aware of that when we sat down and our task force created the proposed supplement, because we had building officials and fire marshals on the committee who said, that's covered in my code, and you can't cover that because we preempt that issue in Connecticut. So what we did was, in every provision within the PMC that conflicted with our state code, we simply modified the PMC to say that the state code provision and the building code see that provision. We deferred to it in each and every case. So we had no conflict. And that's why we had a building official at the head of the task force to make sure, and the state building inspector's presence in the meetings. Yes, sir. And we will. And really all he's doing is updating it to the 2012 version from what we already did in that manner. Thank you.